something that's specifically mentioned in chapter 30 is that the hypothesized AVR on Dromanad can initiate the Nahel bond. Jump to chapter 31. Roque perches on Dusk's shoulder as he's wrangling this serpent, and he thinks to himself, man, I just can't go any further. I just can't do it. This serpent's gonna win. Roque perches on his shoulder, and then he somehow finds the strength to keep going.
Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. Not as much Stormlight today as the last few weeks because we are in the middle of Isles of the Emberdark. We're going to talk about chapters 29 through 33 today. We're going to finish up book two of Isles of the Emberdark, and we're going to get to almost exactly the halfway point in the book. How are you guys feeling so far, Trevor?
I think if you were to describe the Emberdark, it would be the exact opposite of the term Stormlight. It would be like a calm dark.
No, yeah.
So we are the calm dark podcast now. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. A little nervous for the little competition we had at the beginning of the book, but it's fine. We're not there quite yet.
Just to clarify what you're talking about, I have asked Paul and Trevor a little trivia challenge. We're having a little bit of a challenge between our co-hosts here. I've asked them to try to guess when Dusk will speak to Starling, if that will happen at all. And Trevor, I assume by your reaction there, we have not gotten to your page yet.
We've got plenty of time.
he's confident, except the head is shaking over there. Paul, how are you feeling about both your trivia guess and just in general?
I'm feeling great. I didn't expect to have the end of book two yet. This feels more like a book, a part than a book. I feel like we're going to have five parts, like a good old-fashioned Stormlight book here. But yeah, wrapping it up, I feel solid about my predictions, maybe. It depends on maybe how we go forward from here. We have not reached mine yet either for the trivia. But yeah, as you said, we're about halfway through, roughly. I'm looking forward to it. I think this might be my favorite episode. Well, we haven't recorded it yet, but my favorite set of chapters for this episode so far in this book. Some really cool stuff. Really enjoyed reading this.
We get some what I think might be some iconic moments in the Cosmere, because we get to see a certain something for the first time. Trevor, you want to try and summarize it for us? You ready for that?
Yeah. I'll do Dusk first. He flips his boat over on purpose, and then he flips his boat over again, and then he kills a snake, and then he talks to someone. And then Starling goes to Silverlight. It's a tapestry. It's not a paper. It's human hair. And then talks to someone. And then that's about it for Starling.
These new minimalistic chapter summaries. I'm digging it.
A little bit less substantive.
Yeah, you're keeping the tension. You're keeping the tension there. We've got some big stuff in this chapter, and you're setting the scene, though. Set the scene.
It's pretty funny. Yeah, you forgot that. Did you include that Dusk has something to drink and has a conversation?
I did say talk to someone, but I didn't say drink water.
Well, yeah, he sort of drink or which snacked.
Is big news in
kinda the like Dusk. Yeah.
Universe.
He got a snack.
True. Are we going to talk about Dusk first and leave all of the Silverlight suspense for the back half of the episode?
Let's go ahead and do that. Since, yeah, there's not so much crossover between the two yet.
I have a confession.
Go ahead.
So I set up the outlines for the episode. And in the outline, I put chapter 29 through 32, not through 33, which is what we are covering today. And about, I guess it was 4 hours ago, as of recording this, Paul and Elliot get in the podcast chat between the three of us and say, does Trevor know that it's through chapter 33? And I saw that notification arrive on my phone. And then I looked at the clock and I said, yeah, I got time. So then I read chapter 33. So I've read chapter 33 once about 3 hours ago, and I'm ready to talk about it.
I find that hilarious. And I did specifically tag you in that comment in the case that that might have been the case. And I know you have a fairly long commute home from work and thought you might need to sneak that chapter in on the way.
But it's fine. It's fresh on the brain. I'll just put it that way.
I am glad I sent that. And I may or may not have sent a message in our Discord because it may or may not have happened to other people on the podcast as well. Not pointing fingers. But yeah, just want to make sure we all knew through chapter 33. And chapter 33 is a really cool chapter, but I don't want to skip too far ahead.
We got to kill a snake first, and then we can talk about chapter 33.
Well, first we have to attempt to kill a snake.
Right. So
and then we have to kill a snake. Yeah.
So Dusk ties himself to his boat, flips it over, throws the worm paste on it, and then tosses it. Well, he doesn't intentionally, but he leaves it intentionally. He tosses his rag that he was using to spread his worm paste out, and then a snake comes and grabs it. And he's like, oh, great. They react to investiture, or his equivalent of investiture. And so he then spears the snake. But he did the rookie mistake of tying the harpoon line to the side of the boat as opposed to the front of the boat. And so he gets dragged sideways through the Emberdark until he almost capsizes and cuts his harpoon, loses a harpoon. Rookie mistake, Dusk. I expected better from you. You're out of practice. Second time, way better composure here. He spears a snake, lassos it for all eternity. A very specific order of events happens, and then he shoots the snake 6 times in the head.
Yes.
Now, I have never gone deep sea fishing. However, even for someone like Dusk, a master, to be fair, I should specify, he mentions he has caught or hunted sea creatures at this size before, this size of beast before. So it actually is much more plausible. However, I didn't think that this would be something that Dusk could do. I didn't think he would be able to successfully spear it, wear it down, reel it in, kill it himself.
In chapter 31, which I think is much more relevant now that I've also read chapter 33, he specifically says, hey, thanks, Father, for preparing me for this type of thing. That's what you were doing the whole time. And I was like, oh, yeah, my theory is going to be right. And then I was going to have this whole thing about how autonomy is prepping him for this whole thing. And then 33 rolls around and it's just like explains it word for word, but we'll get there. Has anyone on this podcast read The Old Man and the Sea by Ernest Hemingway?
I was going to bring this up.
Technically, yes, I read it in high school for an assignment.
I also read it in high school for an assignment.
I remember it quite vaguely. So okay. I will allow you to enlighten
us. But before you talk about this, I will say my recollections of this book, which I'd also read in high school, were very short. It was, the book's pretty short, I think.
70 pages. I think it's 75 pages.
I read the whole thing in one sitting, closed the end of the book and was like, that was really dumb.
Thank you. Okay. This was exactly my experience of it in the same high school that Elliot went to. I was assigned The Old Man and the Sea, and the entire book, for please, if there's any apologists in the comments, please let me know. Somebody come to the defense of this book because we're about to tear it apart. All it is this guy. Does he have a wife? I don't even remember if he has a wife. And like, he neglects his life and he must go catch this fish. And every day he goes out and catches this fish, and finally he catches this fish and he reels it in for days. I believe it's like weeks. He fights for this fish and he finally grabs it and he reels it in and the sharks have ate it. And he doesn't even get the fish. It's just bones. And then he goes home and goes to sleep, and that's the book. Is that the memories you guys had of the book?
Exactly.
That's as much as I could tell you about the book.
Yeah, essentially. I'm sure there's some deep meaning behind it, but...
Well, the meaning is you can't get super obsessed with one thing in your life, and you shouldn't be completely... Like, I do understand it as an adult now. It shouldn't be assigned to a junior in high school who's going to think it's stupid. But I could not get that out of my head as we were getting dragged through the Emberdark by Moby Dick snake guy here. And we finally shoot it in the back of the head 6 times. Yeah. I'm glad you guys had the same reaction I did to both the book and this book reflecting that book.
I actually had another thought here, because the whole... One of the major premises of hunting this fish was Dusk was like, ooh, if there's life out here, I can eat it, right? He says that in a previous chapter. I don't think it's in either of these. And I'm just like, why was he going... If you're going to go out into Shadesmar, the Emberdark, I'm not thinking like, yeah, I'll forage for and hunt for food. That was not on my that was not in my thought. Like, whatever food you're gonna need to survive, you're gonna have with you. I just, the premise of that was kind of crazy to me, that we're out here hunting for food hypothetically in the Emberdark.
I think it's been like a week or two at this point. I think he brought food. He just didn't maybe have space or time to prepare like months worth of food.
Right. And it specifically says he's not in dire straits right now. Like, he still has food and water, but he's going to need to figure something out pretty quick. And he does figure out snake hunting. So that's cool.
Yeah. This is literally the like historic trial and error figuring stuff out. Even when he successfully kills it and starts to eat it, he like eats a little piece to see like, okay, is this going to poison me?
Yeah.
Make me sick? Or is this going to be okay? And stuff like, there's no like, let's test or analyze. It's just, well, I'm either going to die right now or I'm going to survive. And that's the end of it. So old fashioned technique.
I appreciated the use of the term snake steak. Try to say that 10 times fast. But when the audible term snake steak came to my ears, I thought that was quite funny.
Since we're talking through it all, you guys want to see it? You guys actually specifically said in a previous episode, 2 or 3 episodes ago, that you were dying to see what a skull snake actually looked like. And that you had some thoughts, but you weren't quite sure what it was supposed to picture. Well, the artist, whose name I've kind of been trying to specifically not say because I know I'm going to butcher it, I'll skip to the last name, Esther Kandari is the artist. She has drawn it for you right here.
Dusk looks quite happy.
He does. He's having a great time right now.
Yes.
And, also, I'd like to point out that our snake is definitely not a 5-to-1 ratio here. It is definitely more than 5 times long than it is wide. Definitely. which makes me very glad, because a 5-to-1 ratio snake would have been terribly weird and ugly. So this is really cool, fantastic. I got the image description in the audiobook, and afterward I instantly was like, I have to go see this picture. There's art of this. Absolutely have to go grab my book and open it up. And that's what I did. Fantastic art. It even adds to the like crazy kind of edgy navigator versus beast battle, the fact that he has like a crow sitting on his shoulder too.
Raven,
my apologies.
How
black
dare you?
Bird on his shoulder, who is, by the way, digging his claws into his skin, which was kind of like pretty metal, you know. And also, like, is that necessary? Like, couldn't he? I mean, he's got his shoulder strap there, but
okay.
Surely there's a better answer for that, right?
I have something to talk about with the bird on his shoulder thing. Okay. In the book, for the audio description, it specifically says that Sock is on his shoulder as he reels in the snake, which is what you see on your screen right now. However, in the chapter, it's not Sock that's on his shoulder. It's Roque for the first time. Roque perches on his shoulder for the first time as he's reeling in the snake. Let's back up for a second. Chapter 30 we'll talk about shortly. But something that is specifically mentioned in chapter... it's actually 32. 30. Something that's specifically mentioned in chapter 30 is that the hypothesized AVR on Dromenad can initiate the Nahel bond. Jump to chapter 31. Roque perches on Dusk's shoulder as he's wrangling this serpent, and he thinks to himself, man, I just can't go any further. I just can't do it. This serpent's going to win. Roque perches on his shoulder, and then he somehow finds the strength to keep going. That screams Kaladin back in the bridge runs. Absolutely 100%. Roque has perched on his shoulder, initiated their first Nahel bond, given him investiture to keep pushing through this snake hunt.
Yeah, this was something that I keyed into as well. I specifically remember thinking while this was happening, this is a bit unrealistic that he could wrestle this, right? Like I said, you know, he's dealt with deep sea creatures, and we don't know the true strength of this beast, right? It's possible that this guy's a pushover, this skullfish, you know, you never know. But my instincts are telling me he's not. So I didn't think this would be possible for an uninvested being, for an uninvested person to do. So that got me thinking, is Dusk invested? We do see some things later on in chapter 33, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But here in this chapter, we've learned, is in this episode or the last, that, you know, AVR can do the Nile bond, can form a Nile bond. And I'm like, that's got investiture written all over it. He must be in some way invested, in strengthened or something, without probably knowing it. It's pretty cool.
I absolutely love these questions and these observations that you guys are making for sure. I want to point out one thing or throw in a few questions of my own. As far as we've seen up until this point, maybe there's some exceptions, but none are coming to mind. Investiture has been a finite resource. You absorb X amount of it. You spend X amount of it doing things, you are left with none afterwards. I'm looking for that here, and I'm not really seeing it, because I'm with you guys in the whole the investiture something has got to be going on here. But The birds appear to eat the invested worms once. Well, and then they do the cool things they do forever.
I would argue that it is investiture tapeworms, that you're eating a parasite and it stays in you forever, and then you just siphon it off whenever you're, you know, doing your thing.
So the investiture tape, this is a terrible term. We need to not let this stick. That
how about nightmares. In tapeworms? I was deathly afraid of tapeworms growing up. Like you see that slideshow, horrible. Whatever it is, like horrible. Seventh grade science class when they teach parasite. You about tapeworms. And I was terrified of tapeworms. I would like check my food every day.
Well, parasite. We'll say parasite. That's still scary, but not ass.
Investiture glowworms. Is that better?
There we go.
I was too scared to watch it, but I remember watching Animal Planet growing up. I loved it. But there was a show they aired called Monsters Inside Me, which was called stuff like that. Absolute nightmare fuel. I never have watched it and never will. That's for sure.
All right. So Sock has an investiture glowworm inside her. Okay. So the glowworm, though, is it then kind of continuously transforming food into investiture?
Feasibly. Yeah. I could see that. But like
it's
so whatever's happening, the snake is not doing that.
Or is it?
No, because the snake's investiture fades like immediately. Whereas, unless you're saying that the invested being from the snake is dying.
Or is the skull snake just a really large glowworm itself? It doesn't have a parasite. It is right. The parasite.
Yeah. So now he has a sea snake and growing inside him.
Yeah, maybe. So the skull snake is the being metabolizing food into investiture. Maybe. Right. These are the questions I'm asking: is if investiture is still finite, what's creating it? Where right. are we getting more of it as we spend it? I'm having a hard time unraveling that.
And it's not a cognitive realm thing either, because the AVR do their thing both correct. On cognitive and physical realm. So
correct.
Yeah. Interesting. I don't know what our currency is for AVR investiture, right? Like where's our scale? Yeah, that's a great question. All right. Chapter 33. Dusk eats his snake steak and then eats the glowing section. Like he cuts it into like cucumber slices and is snacking on them. And then there's one part that's like still glowing and the rest of the snake is like definitely not glowing anymore. He eats part of that, goes to sleep, and then hears vroom, 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 and wakes up. And Patchy presumably says, "What's up?"
Well, he hears the vroom vroom, and then he grabs a handful of worm paste and takes it to the max. And then he hears a voice, in addition to
the distinctly the deep male voice.
Ah,
which okay, Paul, what do you remember from the Lost Metal? On autonomy.
Very avatar heavy, right?
Yes.
Sets up an avatar and mostly makes them run things.
Do you remember who holds autonomy, the vessel of autonomy, and then who puts all the avatars out?
I do not remember. Who holds the vessel of autonomy?
I almost pulled the Lost Metal out to read this quote for quote, and I probably should have. But chapter 19 of the Lost Metal. Marcy is in an undercover operation driving into Bilming, and Moonlight hijacks her car and is her driver. Who's Moonlight? Do you remember?
Shy.
Shy from Emperor's Soul. is a Ghost Blood. This is before our big Ghost Blood powwow in the Lost Metal. Miracy asks Moonlight, hey, what's up with autonomy? And Moonlight says, all right, here you go. If you had 16 pieces of unique art, how would you make yours the coolest? And they go back and forth on, I would destroy them all. I would steal them all. I would, you know, make everybody else's super common. And Moonlight tells Maracy and the reader that autonomy is going throughout the Cosmere making avatars. And the holder, the vessel of autonomy, is held by Bavadin, a woman. All that to say, we are not speaking to Bavadin in Chapter 33. What I believe we are speaking to is Bavadin's avatar Andromenad, Patchy.
That would make a lot of sense because we haven't talked about Starling yet, but they mentioned
they do
that there allegedly may be an avatar on Patchy. So that would totally add up, and I think you're onto something there for sure. It seems to be autonomy seems to be the name thrown out the most here. So
yes,
that's certainly what we're led to believe right now.
And if you remember to the end of The Lost Metal, that this is definitely spoilers for Lost Metal if you haven't read it. Wax confronts Bavadin like specifically. It's not Telson, his sister, it's not the avatar, it's the shard. He like has a confrontation with the shard Bavadin. And so that leads me to think that the shard is way more involved against Scadrial than it is here. It's definitely one more step removed than Dromenad, or than it was on Scadrial. Does that make sense? Like, I'm expecting autonomy to be way less involved than she was in The Lost Metal. And this is just like a remnant of whatever autonomy was doing on Dromenad.
The words that they say, the dialogue that they have, also to me definitely seem to point towards autonomy.
Yeah.
Dusk just thinks this is Patchy and, oh, you've tested me and all this stuff. But one of the things that the voice says back to him was, I have given you the tools, go forth and discover my will, Trapper, for no victory is warranted unless it is earned, and each planet must stand on its own or be consumed. Like, that just screams autonomy, right?
Yeah, it really does.
But what's
What's the line a little bit further down that... go ahead and finish your thought on autonomy, and then I'll ask you a question on that page, so don't lose that page.
What else was I going to say? Oh, your point on, are we talking directly to the vessel holder of autonomy, or are we talking to an avatar? Yeah, I do think that's going to be an important distinction, but I do think we're talking in the direction of autonomy somehow.
Sure.
What was your other thought?
Yeah, my other thought, a little bit further down on the page, maybe the last paragraph of the chapter. Dusk has a line about a map, about creating the map. Can you read it?
If I can find it. This is where he starts to realize he can Polynesian wayfind his way with the thrum.
Right.
He's hearing. He's like, oh, these are like waves of the ocean. I've done this before.
It might be the last line of it. Look at on the other page. It might be the last line of the chapter.
So the last thing of the entire of the chapter, which is the last thing of all of book two, is he grabbed his oar. Come on, he said, we need to fill in this map. There's a large interruption in that direction, warping the current of this place. Lower sea current, by the way. It feels far away, but let's see if we can reach it.
Okay. So this made me hypothesize. I went off on a crazy tangent as I was listening to this. What is the goal of the Scadrians? I'm stuck on this. What is the goal of the Scadrians in this book?
The Scadrians that we've seen before?
The ones above. What is the goal of the ones above in this book? I had a term thrown at me for the first time. Maybe not for the first time, but definitely for the one of the first definitive times. Starling, in her chapter, describes the cognitive realm near inhabited places in the physical realm as the subastral. That term, Paul, did you catch that term when she used it?
Yes, but I went straight past it. It kept going.
Okay.
Didn't think much about it.
Let me reel you back in on the term. She uses the term to describe the cognitive realm around a planet and how the thoughts of the people on that planet shaped the subastral in the region, is how she describes it. That keyed me into all of the different versions of Shadesmar we've ever seen. The unsee, the beat ocean, the weird mist stuff going on Scadrial. Anytime we've been on the cognitive realm, it's always been a little bit different based on where you are. This is explaining this. They describe it as the subastral, and around Silverlight, it's like this really thin layer of glass that you can walk on or something like that over the Nexus. And presumably on Shadesmar, it's all the little beads, because everything is beads on Roshar, and then the mists and, you know, all that. So to say that, when a how do I summarize this? When a planet begins to understand their cognitive realm, they shape the ground in their cognitive realm. I think that's what the Skadrians are trying to do to Dromenad. Forget the birds for a second. They're trying to find the perpendicularity. That's the big thing here. They're trying to get the Dromenad people. They're trying to get Dusk's people up to current day. So they go to the cognitive realm and create a bunch of land so that the Skadrians then can find the perpendicularity. Are you with me, Paul?
Yes.
Follow all that?
Yes. So
I'm wondering if we're going to have some like flip of the Dromenad system that enough people know about the cognitive realm so that they delete the unsee and create like this massive landmass like everything else has. And then the Skadrians are sitting in the Emberdark and they're like, oh, it happened. We can go find the perpendicularity. That's where my brain's at.
Or even that could be the finding method. Is they're just out there flying over the unsee, waiting for the land to appear.
Correct.
Because once they think about it hard enough, then the island or the land is going to solidify, and then bingo, like they don't have to look anymore because the points them right there.
Because everywhere else in the cognitive realm, water is land and land is water. But that's not the case for Dromenad. Land Correct. Is land and water is water. But that's because they don't, I think, based on what Starling says in chapter 30, I think they don't have enough people thinking about their cognitive realm to create the sub-astral Dromenad. I think. Anyway. That was a big tangent. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. You're talking. So I still, to this day, what we were introduced to Shadesmar in like, I don't know what episode of our podcast, but like early on, I don't know, episode 10 or something like that, probably. I still don't know what to make of how things work. A couple episodes ago, we were talking about, like, could Dusk go out at X amount of distance and then turn around 180 degrees and go back? And we were like, well, if you're even a half a degree off, you're not going to make it back. You're going to make it way off. I'm like, okay, but now, like, I've thought since then, like, okay, what if he really focused hard and thought about 180 degrees? Would he be successful?
Yeah.
Because he's thinking enough about turning 180 degrees. Here with the directions and all this stuff, it makes me wonder about that as well. I feel like the short answer should be that should not be possible, but also the short answer to that should be yes, that is possible. And I don't know where to stand on it, you know.
And I'm loving all these questions. I'm wrestling with all of my own as well. I think we should let them sit for now and keep going on, because we still have some big stuff to talk in this episode, and we still have more of a book to read. I think we're going to be coming back to these questions later. You guys okay with moving on to Starling yes. And Silverlight.
I had one other thing I wanted to talk about, Trevor, with Trevor as an idea. We talked in 33 about Patchy, right? Trevor is predicting or thinks that this is an avatar of
autonomy.
Sorry, yes, autonomy here. My gut instinct. So first, as soon as we hear this voice, my brain is okay. I'm thinking like, okay, this is something. We're not making this up. This is something big. What could it be? It's not a shard, most likely. Maybe it's possible it is a shard, but I'm going to say no. My thought was that this is the spread of the planet.
Okay.
And I don't know how that could be, but I feel like that'd be a cool reveal in this book, especially as we think Cosmere forward from here. Or at least Cosmere forward from Stormlight 5, wherever we are in the timeline. There's a lot of mentions, I think, in Stormlight and other places about, you know, we have the spread of the tower and these other things, and talks about the tones of Roshar. I wouldn't be surprised if we end up meeting the spreads of full planets.
Okay.
So that's where my brain has been. I don't know if that holds much weight, but that's instantly, like, coming off, finishing chapter 33, my brain has told me Patchy, who is talking to Dusk here, is the spread of the planet Patchy. The logistics of that, not sure. I don't know how we would have this spread here or what, but that's what it felt like to me. And I don't know the logistics behind it, I guess, but
I like your idea. Let me be contentious with some of your definitions real quick. Dromanad is the planet. Patchy is the island.
Yes.
So I would argue that we are talking to the... I'm not going to use the term Spren. Spren is a very Roshar term. We're talking to the...
entity.
Invested entity of the island. Yes. I would absolutely agree with that. That we are... that the island has been thought of enough, has been invested enough to then personify itself as a... being, and we're talking to that being that has been influenced by autonomy. Absolutely, yes. That is where I'm at.
Especially by Dusk, who this entire right. book has been saying, "Oh, Father Patchy, you right. know, like teaches and guides or whatever." So, I think it's fairly reasonable right now. But anyways, I'm ready to talk about Starling. I think there's really exciting stuff there, but I didn't want to go until we brought that up.
Who is Patchy? I'll have to write that down and bring it up later. But Starling in Silverlight. So we have two chapters here, chapters 30 and 32. Let me set the scene for you a little bit, because this for me was special, and I'd be willing to bet this was even far more special for many of the Cosmere readers out there that are far deeper in this stuff than I am.
Yeah.
Silverlight has been mythical this entire time. It's gotten name dropped very cryptically in a few different places. We know very little about it, and here it is. We arrive in the city of Silverlight, which is a city in Shadesmar or Emberdark, above a perpendicularity that shines this brilliant silver light. up from the bottom. So the entire city is kind of lit from the bottom, maybe the opposite of how we're used to it, right? We're on the surface of Earth, which is kind of lit from above with the sun. So everything lighting wise in this place is going to be the inverse. You're going to be lit from below everywhere you go, which I think the book even says is like takes a little bit of getting used to, is, you know, faces are going to be shadowed in different ways. It's going to be unique. Trevor, you mentioned the glass surface. There's like a physical surface that's like glass, and there's holes in it that ships can go through if they're trying to get to the perpendicularity, on and on and on. This is not the planet of Yolen, because the planet of Yolen is on the other side of that perpendicularity. So if you go through the perpendicularity, this is trippy. Ready? The Silverlight Nexus, which is the name of the perpendicularity, Brandon tells us goes to three different places, which is different than every other perpendicularity out there.
And Yolen is one of them.
Yolen is one of those.
Yes.
And then Brandon forgets to mention what the other two are.
There's a couple dirty ones from Brandon in this one. Okay, so that one, there's three, but it only goes to one. You didn't have to tell us that, Brandon. You could have just said it goes to Yolen and then surprised us with that one later. There is a specific line of dialogue about harmony in a second that's really just really a gut punch. And I'll just go ahead and say it now. Our Arcanist, Ed, is a Pathian, and he's geeking out about something. And he says Harmony, presumably. I don't think he mentions the name Harmony, but whoever he is praying to as a Pathian, which last we knew was Harmony, the person he is praying to that is Skadrian as a Pathian, he says he is the only living shard who has performed the
dot dot dot.
And then Starling interrupts him and says, "We know this already. Tell us something important."
Dirty.
Such a dirty.
Dirty.
I cannot. Usually I laugh at these types of things, but this one was so abrasive and offensive, Brandon. I cannot get over the fact that you just like dangle this in front of us. I bet he doesn't even know what he performed, and he just puts this out there as like bait.
Well, since we went straight to it, let's talk about this for a second, and we'll go back to Silverlight as a city. I want to fill that gap with something specific that we know already.
I also do, yes.
But that should be contradicted by something that we also know already.
I would agree with this 100%.
Because, you know, we've read Mistborn. If you out there have not, please go do that right now, because I'm about to spoil all of it.
And Yumi. There's a line in Yumi.
But go read Mistborn, please. I'm going to spoil all of Mistborn Era 1 right now.
And 2.
Yes, also 2. What he could be referring to here is the double ascension. The ascend to two different shards. He is the only known living shard who has performed the double ascension.
Correct. He could say that.
Because prior to reading Wind and Truth, that's what I would obviously have filled that gap with. There's something very unique about Harmony as a shard. He's the only one who has done that. But we just read Wind and Truth, which we're 99.9% sure happens prior to this book we're reading now. And Taravangian just did it again.
Yep.
By the way, we're spoiling Wind and Truth, if that wasn't obvious. So what is he referring to?
Okay, I agree to all the points you said on completely different context. So I was going to say the word splintering.
Okay.
I was about to fill in the blank with he's the only known living shard who has performed a splintering of himself. Throw to Yumi, where Virtuosity splintered herself on the planet and it did all sorts of crazy things. I wonder if that blank is splintering, and he's the only living shard to have done it successfully. And he has successfully splintered himself away from ruin and preservation, and he's now one of them.
But are you implying a few things when you go down that logic path? We haven't seen Harmony splinter himself.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Like,
we think he might.
Yeah.
But we haven't seen that.
Or it could be he's the only living shard to have performed the transformation, and he's changed his shard. Like,
right.
Like I said before, this is so dirty, Brandon. One more word could have given us so much, and you didn't.
Yep. Paul, are we missing anything? Is there anything here that's blowing your mind?
I mean, it's all kind of crazy. I think y'all covered everything I was thinking through in this part. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wild. Again, the presence of ... on the page is so loaded. It's incredible. All right.
Let's back up and talk about Silverlight a little bit more.
Yeah, let's go that way. So we land on Silverlight, crazy cool city. What'd you guys pick up at that point?
Super tall skyscrapers that aren't possible anywhere else because of dragon steel. And as modern as it gets, maybe even sci-fi as it gets. I mean, we have starships, so you could imagine more sci-fi than modern. And there's a whole bunch of like geometry things going on with these skyscrapers that are weird and break the laws of physics. And it specifically reminds Zietzi of his grand apparatus of breaking the laws of physics. And then we get a couple name drops, which we'll talk about in a second, but we are here to meet with Zeiss and plead guilty for mutinying his Captain Crow.
We do. But before we go there, Paul, you have this in the outline. Starling chats with the Irioli family, and they give her something. What do they give her?
They give her, as Trevor so succinctly mentioned, she gets a piece of canvas here, a map fragment, if you will. I think back to like ancient manuscripts that we have in real life and how they're not in one piece, they're in a bunch of pieces, you know, just over time. And this is a piece of, so there's a couple of things. First and foremost, we are learning the Irioli have this big, grand cosmic map, essentially, that was made years and years ago, like ancient history for them. And
the Long Trail.
The Long Trail, yes, that's what it's called. And we, as in modern day people in this story, have some of that. We know some of it, but we do not have all the pieces of this map. And people try to make up stuff with this and earn a quick buck by saying, I've got a Irioli fragment of the Long Trail. And they try to con you out of some cash. But this is alleged to be a real piece of the Long Trail. Not only a real piece of it, but a piece that shows a perpendicularity that is not on anybody else's map. So I imagine we're going to try to find this perpendicularity. We'll talk about that more as Starling uses that to look to barter with Zeiss later on. But this was really cool. This felt like it gave me purpose for the Irioli. We've seen them go all over. We know they're trying to find a homeland or something like that, or a good place to live. But it sounds like they've also been taking notes, and they know where they've been going and where they have been. It does also sound like the Irioli like kind of know this already.
Did you
think they mention it like that? But anyways.
Did you catch why the Eerie family misinterpret their own map? I thought this was really cool.
I don't know if I did.
Okay, so Ed's a super nerd. And he mentions something about numbers and alphabet being like the same thing for the Irioli or something like that. And it has progressed. Their language has progressed over the years. And so the Eri family that had this heirloom try to read the tapestry in modern Eriali, but they need to back up their language a couple hundred years, and it actually tells them to go the other way. Like there's a negative sign missing or something like that. And so Ed knows this because he's a super nerd. And so he knows how to read this map, and the Eri family that just gave it to them don't. And that's why they are in the middle of nowhere.
Okay. He does also mention that while he has his estimate, his hunch as to where it is, he's not 100% certain because all the mentions of old language, old Eriali is very difficult and challenging, and he'd love to get a second opinion from another expert, you know? Yep. So, yeah, I missed that, though, but yeah, they make a lot of mentions of how the language, how the structure has, and they even talks about the places on the map aren't the same landmarks or names of places that you would know today. They had different landmarks. Thankfully, it shows Silverlight on here, which he can, and lets out like a sigh of relief that, okay, Silverlight, I can at least use that as a reference point and plan from here. There's been a lot of wayfinding in this book, and I didn't realize I was such a big fan of wayfinding, but apparently I am. I absolutely love it. Every time I'm like, this is so cool. I would love to sit here and plot with this map, you know? So cool. But yeah, so that's what's going on. That's what Starling gets from the Eriali family here. And she, the whole time she's like, ha ha ha, thank you. It's not real though, by the way, until later on.
I wonder if the other Arcanists that Ed is going to go show this to is going to keep a secret, if they're proper scholars and keep scholarly secrets, or if they've been bribed by Zeiss or somebody else. And I wonder if we're about to go get like a literal race to the perpendicularity to go plant your flag on it, if he goes and shows this to a bunch of other people.
One other thing we get in chapter 30 is a quick name drop. You guys catch it?
Yes, I did. I was going to ask you for a spell check on it to make sure this is the same person, but Huyo is here in Silverlight.
It is spelled the same as Lopin's cousin. He does have a lot of those, but Huyo, Lopin's cousin from Roshar, is apparently an Arcanist.
Cool.
Here on Silverlight. Yeah.
Frankly, whenever I heard this, he was like, "Ooh, I'm going to have to talk to Huyo about this." Like, talk to Huyo about this being this map with old Eriali. I laughed out loud, and I knew this is Brandon just having way too much fun with the Cosmere.
Oh, yeah.
And where the Cosmere is going, because I don't know. This made me laugh. It was funny. I'm not taking this to heart like too deeply, but it honestly made me think like, wow, okay, so our Arcanists are not very bright. Like they're not very...
Well, that's rude.
You know, it is rude, but that's where my mind went initially. I'm sure he's deserving of his status right now, but he knows he was pulling a good joke whenever he had Huyo here.
At least it's not Lopin.
Grand Arcanist. You're right. Yeah, absolutely. Just his cousin, who's totally way better.
And I asked you guys specifically at the beginning how many familiar characters you thought we might meet.
I need as many as possible.
I wrote it down. I don't remember off the top of my head what you guys said. We'll tally it up when we get to the end. But I'm gonna count this one as we go as a familiar character. So he's not in the scene, but he's name dropped, so that's close enough.
Feeling pretty good about my prediction. I don't remember what it was, but it was high. Okay. On to Zeiss. So Zeiss has contracted the dynamic. Technically, we hijacked his ship, so we have to go apologize. Crow gets there first and has some behind the doors conversation that we don't see. And then Starling goes up to chat with Zysus, ultimately throws the gambit of the Irialli map, but that's not till the end. Yeah, she tries to talk him into keeping the crew together and going to chase this perpendicularity.
Plenty of little nuggets throughout this chapter.
Yes.
Nothing too giant maybe is revealed here, but yeah, big moment. Starling has to face Zysus, who...
This is the first name drop of autonomy officially in the book, by the way. Like I name dropped it a couple episodes ago, but this is just proving how smart I am.
Zysus is backing you up, I think. This is definitely a point in your favor with your autonomy theories of Zysus. Very strongly hints that autonomy was on Dromanab.
And he also very heavily implies that it was a past tense thing.
Correct.
That like autonomy used to do this and doesn't anymore. Is the vibe I got. And I was like, oh, interesting. So autonomy has progressed from this avatar thing, and maybe Patchy's just like a leftover of it from back in the day. I thought that was interesting.
I was definitely getting some Bond villain vibes from our Zysus bro here. I feel like huge, he was huge crime boss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crime boss pulling all the strings behind the scenes. I feel like he was actually far scarier in Tress. Maybe that's just because he was in dragon form. Like I was just waiting for him to eat somebody in
Tress. No, in Tress, he's like an old grandpa. He like laughs at them and like has fun. Right. And
but he's like grumpy and gonna eat you any second kind of dragon. No, this is more like this is more like, yeah, crime boss Zysus.
You like jazz?
he's way more scary here than he was in Tress. Tress, he's like. Tress, he just sits there and entertains them both as they both try to sell each other to Zysus, and he like thinks it's funny. And like my estimation of scary dragons in the Cosmere went down after Tress. I don't know about you guys. And then here he's like actually a scary villain dude.
Okay, Trevor, I know exactly what you're saying, and I think after Tress, maybe my view of dragons as possibly like ruling forces in the Cosmere went down, but my view of their power did not.
Sure.
And here you do see a very, very different thing. So he's like in a suit and talk about wealth. Starling is like, yep, that suit is definitely worth more than my life savings. The suit alone, the chair he's sitting in is probably worth as much as my life savings. Don't even want to know what his piano costs. Fun fact, mm-hmm, exactly. Nice pianos are very expensive in real life. So I'm sure here this Cosmere piano for someone who's been a pianist for 10,000 years, it's probably pretty good. So we get this different look. It's like, yeah, crime boss leader. So yeah, I don't know. It's a different type of menacing.
It was very subtle, but there's a line from Zysus where he tells Starling, when are you going to act like a real dragon? And where real dragons, you know, rule worlds, or even better, own corporations. I thought that was really funny that he's like, be kings of kingdoms and own planets, or own corporations.
A man of business.
Right. Yeah. I just thought that was really funny.
That is really funny. So I thought this was funny. The full name, by the way, right? I'm gonna butcher this. It was like Zyt.
Yeah, y'all should make me try to say it because I have no clue.
I heard it.
Skip the first E. And then
skip
try
the
it.
First E.
Skip the first E, and then that's
Zysus Rifliel.
Yeah, it's Zysus Rifliel.
Zysus Rifliel. Yeah, there we go. I was going to say they say it so fast in the book that I'm like, I don't even know that it would help you, Elliot.
Zysus Rifleo and Illistandrista.
Yes.
Illistandrista. Yeah. She does take her time to say that one, but she does not take her time to say Zysus Rifleo.
Maybe she didn't even know how to say it either. So she's like, all right, we got to run through this one quick.
Right.
We got to go fast to pass this.
We're only doing one take on this one.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, I thought it was really cool. I didn't know dragons had full names, but really digging that. I now wonder what all of our other dragons' full names are. Like Frost, that can't be the whole thing, right?
Right.
No way. Anyways, we also get some other mentions in these chapters from Starling that a little bit of insight into why she may have these the manacles that are on her arms, stopping her powers. She mentions that Frost plays a pretty big part in that. Frost kind of encourages her to essentially do what she thinks is right with her life, do something that she would like to do with her life, rather than follow the, I guess, what is the standard for dragons of ruling over planets and things like that. And I thought that was interesting. And I am more curious than ever to really dive deeper into that and what went on with Starling and Frost and the other dragons. We are getting hints of that, so I feel confident that we will get more callbacks, more information about this. But yeah, I'm quite curious. I don't know if you had other thoughts about that, Trevor.
I keyed into the same thing you did. I understand that Frost was encouraging her to be good, essentially, and all the dragons like got fed up with it of you're supposed to have grown out of this by now, so we're going to punish you with these shackles. I wish I had wrote this down or something, but there's a line from Starling that says, I haven't been able to master the shackles unlike Hoyt has, or something like that. Or I haven't been able to find the workaround for my shackles unlike Hoyt has, or something like that. Is Hoyt a dragon? Genuine question. I've never asked this before. Is Hoyt a dragon?
He's from Yolen, right?
Yes. There's so much evidence in favor of this that I've never even considered it.
There is, you're right. And honestly, what I think of most when you ask that question is in Rhythm of War, we get a lot more insight about Hoyd, and specifically, it's from Yasa's perspective, and she talks about looking into his eyes and just seeing like a very aged depth and like history in his eyes, kind of an unknowable type of history. And first of all, I thought that was beautiful. And awesome, and I love it, and I still think about it. Second of all, I've always taken that to be, it's because he's crazy old, he's been around forever, but I've never thought about whether or not he could be a dragon. We don't know if there are other humans on Yolen, or what, he's really good friends with Frost and Starling, and he's from Yolen.
And he uses his bone phone.
He does use his
phone. In Wind and Truth, remember? So he uses at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book.
There you go. It's basically proved off the bone phone.
Is the bone phone a dragon thing, or is it just Hoyd stealing another artifact?
I'm taking that one specifically as, you know, Hoyd just has another tool in his tool belt.
Right. And that's what I wrote it off as until now. I genuinely am kind of putting my money on Hoyt is a dragon.
I did find the quote. Let me read it to you because it's slightly different than you're remembering, and I took it in a very different way. But it doesn't discount yours. Let me read it. The dragons had an entire infrastructure up there with a flying city. Her manacles now prevented her from accessing that place unless she found a way to break free from them, something even Master Hoyt hadn't been able to do.
There we go. Yeah.
I read that as she tried to get Hoy to help her break her manacles, and even he couldn't do it. So yeah, odds are I'm not going to be able to do.
No, I'm reading it the other way of, I can't break these manacles, and even Hoy couldn't break his.
That's an interesting interpretation I had not thought of, but I could see how you could get that.
Huh. Interesting. I hadn't considered yours before now. I could see how you could
get that. Because that's interesting. Because it could be, okay, Hoid is a dragon, but he's manacled.
Right. And he's been manacled for forever. And he's just
this entire time
crazy dragon human guy now.
Which, okay, let's pull the thread. What has Hoid done that might be similar to what Starling is getting punished for? He chose not to become a god.
Right.
That's kind of what...
Oh, okay. Yeah. Interesting way to phrase that. Yeah, you're right. He didn't, he chose not to go rule his little kingdom thing. Same thing that Starling says.
He chose not to take up a shard.
Yeah.
He participated in the shattering and then did not take a shard.
Uh-huh.
Could the dragons have seen that as non-dragon-like behavior and manacled him?
Interesting.
Yeah. I had not thought about that at all. Until 10 seconds ago.
Huh. Where's his manacles, though? I feel like he'd have to be constantly light weaving over them or something.
Well, but it's Hoid, right? He could totally be doing that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Disguise them so that he doesn't. Wow. Okay.
Similar to Hoid, or involving Hoid, everybody that we trust in the Cosmere is like gone. And I mean like that quite literally. That they're not dead. They're all missing. And the top three that I mean are Hoid, who at the beginning of this book, it was said, oh yeah, and he disappeared. Who batted an eye at that? Nobody, right? Like Hoid just, you know, shows up and leaves and shows up and leaves, and that's just the thing. However, in chapter 32, Zeiss blames Starling for, quote, both of Hoid's deaths, unquote. And he's missing off the dynamic. On top of that, like all of that, I kind of wrote up to Hoid being weird and Hoid. But over the last two chapters, we've also learned that Frost is missing. Presumed dead by Zeiss, and Chris is missing. Where is everybody? Like, if I had a list of top three people that I know what's going on in the Cosmere and going to go talk to them about it, those are the top three, right?
Yeah.
The top three that aren't shards.
Sure.
Yeah. They do talk, by the way, they... Mentioning Chris, we do know where Chris is. Chris is on her home planet, right?
They make the assumption that they know where Chris is.
Ooh, okay.
Same thing they make with Frost. So Zeiss makes the assumption that Frost is dead. And Ed, I think, makes the assumption that Chris is on Taldane.
I'll point out super quick that info does come from Nas. So
okay.
Maybe there's some credibility there, but it's not definitive. He doesn't say, oh yeah, I left her on Taldane. It's more of, yeah, she got called away to go help Taldane. I would not mark that as definitive. Supporting, I think, your theory of people have disappeared.
Everybody's missing. Everybody important is missing. Somebody's on the move and taking people out.
Yeah.
Or
that's true.
Or are they all having an Avengers Assemble moment and they're off fighting something?
Oh, yeah, they're having a powwow. Yeah, that could be. Yeah, that's what I saw. Did you notice that everybody was missing, Paul? Did you get suspicious?
I didn't get suspicious, but I did notice that people are gone. But I assumed that was just like the whispering to you, like, you've got to figure it out yourself. Like,
Sure.
You've got to find the answer in this book somewhere instead of, you know.
And it does answer the meta questions of, well, why don't we just call Frost and he can save the day? Like, you know, it answers the micro story questions of we need to solve our own problems.
Yeah.
Maybe another name we could be on the lookout for to help with our theories and questions here if I was to go further down that list of who are the movers and shakers of the Cosmere, who do I need to keep an eye out for? Who else maybe is on that list?
Is that an open question?
Yes.
Okay. So let's Hoid, Frost, Chris. Like that's gotta be the top three.
Yep. What's the next three?
Let's skip Shards for now.
Yep.
I throw Kelsier out there.
Yep.
Like
Idakar.
Yeah, a Ghostblood, the head of the Ghostbloods, whatever they're doing these days. We'll find out in Mistborn Era 3. After that, well, Shy's a Ghostblood too. I was going to say Shy. After that, the Elantrians. We need to go see what the Elantrians are up to.
I mean, we had our trio of suspects that were popping around Roshar there for a bit, right?
Oh, yeah. They're the 17th Shard. The 17th Shard is hunting Hoid. So,
17th Shard, Ghostbloods. Is that about it?
I feel like there's a big name we've got to be missing.
Zile, maybe.
Nomad. You could throw Nomad into the rank here. Mm,
absolutely.
Okay.
Personally, I'd go see Ishik.
The brigade. Who's hunting Nomad?
Oh, the
who's night after brigade. The Night Brigade. The Dawn Shards.
Ooh, yes.
The Night Brigade.
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Just want to brainstorm a little bit there. See if any other names pop up that are on the missing list, if that might support any theories here. All right. What else? Anything else you guys got out of these chapters? We wring all the information out of them.
I think that's it. Let me consult my notes.
Paul, while he's looking, anything else on your mind?
No, nothing further. Yeah, I think I've shared most of the things I'm looking for and would have had my eyes on.
All right. I think that's it. Besides we're going to go hunt down the Irialli map.
We are going to go hunt down the Irialli map. So yeah, to kind of sum it all up, Starling does fairly successfully bargain with Zysus, and she wins 6 months with her crew on the Dynamic to go off and try to find the secret perpendicularity. If she does, she's supposed to report back so that Zysus has the head start on the information, I guess. Mm-hmm. And if she does not find it in 6 months, then she will be assigned to some random planet to be the god in place of Zysus, basically, something like that.
To rehabilitate her as a dragon.
Yeah, to get her back in the ruling planet's realm of dragons. Alrighty.
I did notice the time frame that puts us well overshooting Dusk's time frame of 2 months. Dusk had 2 months to get back to Dromenad, and Starling has 6 months to get back to Silverlight. So that I just wanted to mention this. I assume we're gonna turn the chapter and this will be changed, but I have yet to see any Isles in our Isles of Emberdark book. I'm waiting to see an island.
What? Well, Isles in the Emberdark, but Dusk sailed past a whole bunch of Isles on First of the Sun.
It's not Isles of the Dromenad system. Isles of the Emberdark.
Okay.
And presumably we're sailing straight towards one now, but we're too...
kind of say that.
How far are we in this book? Halfway?
Almost exactly.
Halfway. I have yet to see any Isles in our Isles of Emberdark.
I suppose that's fair. I have one question for you, Trevor, as a prediction. I would ask Elliot, but I'm sure he knows. So the only other thing I've thought of, you made the joke of, this is not Isles of Dromenad, it's Isles of the Emberdark, right? The only other thing we've seen is, right, Vothi with more of the political drama side over here. Do you think we're going to get any more of that in this book, or have we departed from that and with Dusk's, you know, exploration here?
That's a great question,
actually. I feel like the convergence of this could happen with Dusk and Starling meeting potentially.
Right.
I feel like they could meet and then go to Vothi for whatever reason that we don't know yet. But anyways, I was wondering if you think we'll go back there.
I, of course, assume Vothi is still in the book at some point. If you were to ask me this question before me reading chapter 33, 4 hours ago, and learning that that's the end of book two, I would have told you no. Like, it would be way at the end of the book, and we do some political stuff in, like, the last two chapters or whatever. Now I'm assuming there's four parts to the book, and one of them may be Vothi. We had Dusk. We had Starling. Now I'm wondering if, like, we're actually going to jump to Vothi and she's going to be doing political stuff on Dromedad. Interesting. I hadn't considered that.
So let me ask you guys a follow-up question to that then. If this does get political, and if Starling does get kind of inserted into the picture here, does that help or hurt our Dromedadians?
Well, she's working on behalf of Zysus, so that hurts them.
Okay.
Paul? Like, her personally, I'd be fine with her finding Dusk or the perpendicularity or whatever, but she is contractually obligated to now return to Zysus, so that's a true problem.
That's true. Paul, would it help or hurt the good guys here for Starling to get inserted into the political environment on Dromedad?
I trust Starling enough as a character so far. Could also be skewed by our narrator we mentioned, who is exceptionally making this character seem happy-go-lucky. But I think it would be good for that reason, that I think Starling is good. So, yeah.
Okay. All righty. Any other thoughts or theories?
What if she breaks her contract with Zysus and then settles to be the ruling god of Dromedad? Like, I found Dromedad for you. Exile me to this planet, and I'm going to go live over here.
Happily ever after. All right. Well, I think that should probably do it for our episode here. Any final thoughts from either of you guys?
I'm excited to keep reading. I didn't know that we would be ending book two already, but here we are, and I don't know who book three is or what book three is, but I'm excited to turn the page, metaphorically.
Yeah, me too. I thought book two would be a lot longer. I thought, frankly, we were going to have, like, book two was going to be the last book potentially here, but yeah. How many books do you think they're going to be in this book, Trevor? Real quick number throw. I think we're going to have four.
I also think we're going to have four. Although, at the beginning of this episode, you said five, like a Stormlight book. So you need to decide.
Well, that was my point of reference, but I think there's going to be four.
So I just spoiled myself. I opened my audiobook, and book three is titled The Cave of Death.
Aha.
It is not a person, unlike the first two books. It is titled The Cave of Death. So now I'm less thinking Vothi's involved.
The Cave of Death. Book three. Best way to find out, I think, is to go off and read it.
What's our chapters for next week?
So next week, episode 284, we're going to cover chapters 34, 35, 36, and 37. 34 to 37, the first few chapters of book three. And hope you guys join us then. Thanks, Trevor. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
See ya.